Hello and welcome to another edition of South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. My name is Karthik Nachipan. I'm a research fellow here at ISAS, working on issues related to technology and global governance. And it's my great pleasure today to welcome Manoj Kewalramani, a fellow in China Studies at the Takshashila Institution in Bangalore. Manoj's research focuses on Chinese politics, foreign policy, and approaches to new technologies, including 5G. So today we'll be having a discussion on India's positions, interests, and views with regarding to 5G, and how things have evolved over the last few months, and where India stands right now with respect to 5G. Manoj, welcome.
Thank you so much, Karthik. It's a pleasure to be here.
Manoj, I want to begin by asking if you could just give us, our listeners, some sense of how you got interested in China. You've done a lot of work on China. There's a newsletter which you send out every week, which covers China from Indian perspective. So just help us understand how you got interested in China and China-India relations.
So there's a fun story to begin that, and that's probably where I should begin. My first time visiting the PRC, the mainland, was in 2005. I was somebody who just, I'd done my master's a couple of years ago, and I was trying to figure out my way in the world, hoping to get a journalism job. And I went for a holiday to the mainland because I had family living there, working in one small town in the mainland. I got put on a bus from Hong Kong to Shenzhen. I didn't realize that the buses are going to be changed at Shenzhen. I was then put on another bus, which I didn't know where it was going. And I was told that I'd be reaching the city that I needed to go to by 6 in the morning. The bus stopped in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. At a absolutely vacant bus stop. I got down and I realized that this is the last stop. I kept calling my family member to pick me up, and he was sleeping. And I stood there for about 2 hours at that bus stop, not knowing where I am, what I'm doing, with lots of, which in hindsight I realized, lots of really wonderful Chinese cab drivers asking me where they could take me, and me worried as hell because I didn't know what was happening because I didn't understand the language or anything. And that was my sort of introduction to the PRC in many ways as the country. That after those 2 hours of sort of wondering whether I'm going to end up as a refugee living in a small fishing town in China, because I was in Fujian province by the lakeside, and I didn't know what I was going to be doing over there. Eventually, sort of to cut the long story short, my cousin sort of woke up in the morning at 5:30 and said, "Oh, I'll come and pick you up. You're probably at the right space." And I got picked up in the morning. And my sort of first reaction to that was like, "I am never returning to China. I find this place extremely different, extremely difficult to sort of comprehend, and I'm never coming back there." Lo and behold, I went back there just about every year after that, because my first trip was after that initial day was really, really good. And I sort of got interested in the people, the economy. I think there was a sense of appreciation of the growth that China had experienced, appreciation of culture and so on and so forth. I returned to India, obviously, soon after that, and I was working as a journalist. I worked as a journalist for about 11 years. And in 2011, 2012, I returned to China. I worked there, freelanced there for a couple of years, and then finally worked with state media from 2013 to 2016 with CGTN, setting up digital newsrooms over there. And I think that's the sort of experience that I had with the place, which allowed me to see it in a different light, in some ways see it from devoid of the prejudice of not having been there, and from the outside, sort of the prejudice that you have of a place, and to actually work with people within the system to try and get a sense of how thought processes work, how they view the world, And what are the sort of, in the media specifically, what are the sort of power dynamics? And also from a technology point of view, because in my time over there, this was one of the things that was changing. The argument of China not being able to innovate was sort of being relegated to the dustbins of history. To now, the argument was that, well, perhaps China will out-innovate the West. And it was good to sort of be there and watch the transition of that conversation begin to take place. You know, I left China in 2016, and I've gone back there just about every other year since for conferences, for conversations. And it's been interesting to watch that entire transition. So that was my sort of entry into China, and the interest in that organically grew from journalistic curiosity to greater understanding of the nature of the relationship between India and China. Because starting 2013, you saw the relationship take a far more bitter, if not subsequently sort of hostile tone that we are seeing today. And it was interesting for me at that point in time to sort of go back and say, this is something that's going to be important from an Indian perspective to understand, because a lot of the conversation in India about geopolitics at that point of time was dominated by regionally by Pakistan, globally by the role of the US and India's relationship with the US. There was very little conversation about China. So to me, that was sort of like a low-hanging fruit where I've had the experience of being in the country. I understand some bits of it. And it's a good opportunity to explore this relationship, because this is going to be, from an Indian point of view, if not the, at least one of the pivotal relationships going forward.
Right. So let's now go and talk more about the 5G issue surrounding India and China. Before we talk about some of the core issues surrounding this matter, maybe let's just talk about what 5G is. What advantages does 5G have in terms of economic gains and value as a technology, but also more broadly when we speak about innovation and the future?
So I think the one thing that's important to sort of note before, and I agree with you, and that's a good question to sort of begin with, because it's important for people to understand that 5G is very different from the leap from 4G to 5G is very different from the leap from 3G to 4G. And that's because you're not just looking at an entire new infrastructure in some way, for this, but you're also looking at an exponential leap in terms of the number of devices that can be connected together, the speed, sort of the near zero latency of response time in terms of to your requests, and all of that is facilitated by a completely different sort of module, a completely different base station set. 5G uses technology which is called massive MIMO. And the idea is that MIMO stands for multiple input, multiple output. And the idea is that you use smaller but more of these sets around a location, as opposed to say 4G, where you see these giant towers with, at significant distances. And the objective is that, you have targeted beams which follow users around a cell site. And because you have many more of these, you get faster sort of connectivity and things like that. And there are different sort of bands at which this can be done. But the idea is eventually what this gives a consumer is that you get extremely high speeds of connectivity, you get a massive high sort of density of connectivity. So whereas under 4G, you can have about 4,000 devices per square kilometer that can be connected. Under 5G, if I recall correctly, you can have about around 1 million devices. So you have far greater numbers of people connected, you have far greater extremely high speeds, and you have near zero latency, which is all critical. Because the use cases that 5G will sort of spawn is that it doesn't just mean sort of faster Netflix or YouTube for us, but it also means that, there can be real-time machine-to-machine connectivity, real-time data analytics, which can all eventually sort of spawn new business opportunities. So for example, if you're going to have autonomous vehicles and you need a vehicle that's driving itself to respond to a situation that develops, it needs to process data quickly. And all of the technology essentially sort of links to all of this. If you, and that's the idea. Same case with healthcare. If you're going to be able to connect, you need to have that kind of speed where you need real-time responses. And that's what 5G is sort of essentially going to support. At the end of it, in terms of the kind of economic opportunity that this creates, I mean, there are multiple studies about what is the sort of figures that you can put at it. I think there was a study, I can't remember, the World Economic Forum study or one of those, which talked about how, by 2035, 5G will enable sort of about 12 trillion of global economic output, create about 20 to 22 million jobs around the world. From an Indian point of view, there was a study that the government did, which was published in August 2018, if I recall correctly, and that sort of said that you can estimate the cumulative impact of 5G on the country's economy to be about $1 trillion by 2035, which is significant given that, you know, if you just look at Indian GDP today, it's 2.5 trillion. So there's a significant chunk of opportunity that will be created, new business models, new use cases. And also from a consumer point of view, of course, a very different environment to sort of live in and to work with, right? And it becomes far more important given what we are living through today as the pandemic, that we realize that, you know, the better connectivity that you have, the more sort of opportunities you're going to have. So that's, in that sense, what 5G is, how it's different from 4G, and also the kind of opportunities that it will create going forward.
So a lot of different countries are now in the midst of deciding who is going to, which telecom companies are going to be part of their 5G network. And India is one of those countries. Around mid last year, the government released a statement. METI, the Ministry of Information Technology, released a statement listing the different kinds of vendors and telecom service providers who will be involved, including the Chinese companies. But that appears to have changed off late, although we don't know yet conclusively. So what is the, I mean, what is the state of play in India right now with respect to 5G trials and who will be involved?
I think we're in a bit of a flux, right? In December last year is when the Department of Telecommunications announced that it would be allocating spectrum to conduct 5G trials. And it sort of invited companies for trials, and a bunch of companies sort of put their hands up and said that they would want to be part of it. Four primary sort of operators in India that sort of are part of these trials. So Vodafone Idea, which has just this week gotten rebranded, Bharti Airtel, Reliance Jio, and the state-run BSNL. And these are the ones that have submitted their applications. This is what we found out in January this year. Of these, there were different mixes of partners, of vendors with which these companies wanted to conduct trials. Again, sort of one of the sort of basic facts about the Indian telecom sector that's important to know is that an overwhelming, over 90%+ of India's telecoms equipment is imported. So we rely on foreign vendors overwhelmingly. Whether it's Ericsson, Nokia, Huawei, ZTE, and different companies at different levels have partnerships with each of these for different kinds of products. So four of these service providers essentially said that they would like to carry out trials and submitted their applications. It was really interesting to see that two vendors, two of these companies, service providers, Reliance Jio and BSNL, chose just a single vendor to partner with. Reliance Jio chose South Korea's Samsung, and strangely, the state-run BSNL said that it would be partnering with ZTE, given that there had already been a significant conversation about Chinese vendors and security threats, and given the fact that, and this is all happening in the background, backdrop of this US-China rivalry that had been playing out. So it was very strange that this has sort of come out publicly. Since then, obviously, trials have not happened. Even today, we are unclear as to when trials will happen. There's no official confirmation, but sort of media reports will tell you that there's talk of doing this by next year sometime. In part, the pandemic is to blame for this delay. In part, it's just the nature of India's telecom sector. The Indian telecom sector has been struggling. I mean, if you look back at the history of the Indian telecom sector, it was one of the sort of revolutionary sectors which had sort of, you know, been the sort of poster child for liberalization and reforms and government stepping back and all of that. And it's today in a terrible state for various reasons. One of that is to do with the politics of spectrum allocation and the economics of spectrum allocation. I mean, even today, the Indian government has spoken, valued 5G spectrum at a certain level, which for most players, their argument is that this is unviable for us. The kind of investment that you're requiring from us is just unviable. The other thing is that generally, sort of revenues for Indian companies, for Indian telecom companies, service providers, are poor because over the past couple of years, once Reliance Jio entered the market, it was a race to the bottom to acquire market share, which led to dwindling revenues across companies, and that's another problem because revenues are so poor. Most people don't have capex to invest in 5G and so on and so forth. So pricing of spectrum, the state of the sort of sector as it's in itself, and I spoke about the politics of spectrum pricing, which I sort of want to dwell for a minute on. In 2008, 2009, you had this massive scam over the allocation of spectrum for 2G. And that became this political hot potato, which became this massive scandal about corruption, which was significantly responsible for the sort of fall of the UPA government and the defeat of the UPA government in the elections in 2014. Because it had this cascading effect of leading an anti-corruption movement against the government and all of that, which then led to Prime Minister Modi coming to power in 2014. And since then, it's very difficult for governments in India to look at spectrum as a value-generating resource. You look at it as a revenue-generating resource. And therefore, pricing will always be problematic and will always be high and always be unviable. And I think some of these reasons are the reasons why sort of it's challenging for India to conduct these trials and sort of for companies to commit to conduct trials and also commit to the kind of capex that you need to do to not just invest in new infrastructure, like I said, for 5G, the entire base station set will be very different, but also apply for spectrum, purchase enough of it, and therefore look at revenue given the market is a race to the bottom right now. Now, the market dynamics are changing. Over the last few months, we've seen revenues spike up, the average revenue per user for these companies increase slightly. Yet it's nowhere near where most analysts would estimate it needs to be. Most analysts would want it to be at around 250, 300 rupees per user. At present, at the maximum, it's at about 150, 160. So we have a long way to go.
With the pandemic, as you were saying, there's been a revival of a form of economic nationalism in India or economic self-reliance. Which is domestically known as Atmanirbhar Bharat. How feasible is that vis-a-vis 5G in India? In your excellent 5G essay in the July issue of Seminar, which covered India and the global governance of technology, you argue that there's one faction that advances the indigenization of the 5G network as a way to protect against for economic and national security. A few days ago, there was a report that detailed Reliance Jio's game plan for 5G using 100% homegrown technologies and solutions. Even though most telecom equipment, as you mentioned, around 90% is imported, can Reliance Jio make 5G in India?
So I think the short answer to that is no, because it's not feasible. It's just not economically feasible. You don't make the kind of products that you need for that to happen. That report that detailed what Reliance Jio's plan is talks about something that even we've spoken about and as a model for India to do, even from the point of view of with regard to security concerns, with regard to dependence on foreign vendors, was about designing in India and manufacturing in trust in sort of countries where you'd sort of have greater trust. So Japan, Taiwan are places where you can possibly manufacture, but designing in India. And that to me is feasible. In some measure that is feasible, yes. But again, we're talking about scale and we're talking about designing. You can't be designing and scaling the entire 5G set in India. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. Supply chains are far more complex than that. So I think that some of that we need to take with a pinch of salt. But the other argument that, the argument that I was making in my paper about the sort of lobby which talks about indigenization, their argument is essentially, and I've been to conferences, met with most of these people who argue for indigenization. And I think that their argument for it from a security point of view, It makes complete sense. The only way you're going to get full security is if you completely indigenize, of course. But is that, firstly, is that economically viable? Secondly, do you have the manufacturing capacity to do that? And if you want both of those to, I'm not sure if the economic viability will ever be the case, but if you're talking from the point of view of manufacturing capacity, and that's what you want to invest in, how quickly can you scale up that capacity? What is it going to take from the point of view? Because it's not just about capital, right, to build all of that. It's also about skills. It's also about, you know, having the right kind of manpower and all of that. Having your factor markets open to making that manufacturing also economically. And I think that requires deeper reforms. And I don't think that that's being thought through. I think that's where, to me, the flaw in that argument lies. And then you therefore have other sets of that argument, which says that, you know, well, but do we need 5G? You know, it's not like India has phenomenal 4G coverage. India has significant 4G coverage. But I mean, data from last year that I have was that broadband penetration in India was 47%. Compare that to China at 95%. 4G mobile internet penetration in India is at sort of 90% of users can be on 4G network by 2020. That is what we'd hope for, you know, but still there's a significant number that has to still happen. So are we, and this is again, you know, we are talking about a larger market that needs to get onto 4G as yet. So, and I think if you've sort of done conferences, you know, online over the last few months, people have done, you've realized the challenges of some of these things. So are we, the argument from this set of people is that, is it important for India to therefore invest in this right now? Our challenges are not about autonomous vehicles and things like that. Our challenges are right now about just penetration. So people have the opportunity to be connected and therefore sort of get the network effects and value generation from that. You know, at a certain level, I'm sympathetic to that thought, but I also realize that if you don't do this right now, you're going to lose opportunities for the next generation or two. You know, and you can't, and therefore you hear arguments like, maybe we can skip 5G and go to 6G, but I don't really know what 6G is. And I don't think these people also know what 6G is or what it will mean. And can you have the next generation after 5G? What is the infrastructure that you need for that and so on and so forth? So I think somewhere these arguments are misplaced. And at the end of it, we will need to have Indian service providers working with foreign vendors. It is not just in our economic interest, but to me, it's also in our strategic interest, because you want to be plugged into global supply chains. You don't want to be decoupled from global supply chains. And therefore, I think that you will see some of these. I think the sort of argument of Atmanirbharta, to me, the government is still sort of defining what Atmanirbharta means. What does self-reliance mean? Does it mean autarky, or does it mean being plugged into global supply chains, but in critical areas, working with trusted partners and increasing your own manufacturing capacity and those sorts of things? To me, that's what they're trying to define it as. But we still need to see how that actually plays out on the ground right now. Because at the moment, India's challenges are about steadying the sort of bleeding that this pandemic has caused economically. And that will require a tremendous amount of government investment, also foreign capital and attracting, because, you know, at the moment we're in a place where all capital should be good capital, because we will need the money. So I think that somewhere some of these arguments about Atmanirbharta are slightly disingenuous, particularly with regard to technology, emerging technologies, because we don't have the capacity right now. Plus, it might not be in our strategic interest to be decoupled. But secondly, if Atmanirbharta is defined as creating trust bubbles while being connected with the global supply chain and supporting your manufacturing, that makes sense to me. But I've still not seen a roadmap to do that.
Right. You know, as you mentioned, the geopolitics around 5G has become increasingly fractious and polarizing. Right? The Trump administration appears intent on transforming the landscape around which Chinese tech companies operate to asphyxiate them. You know, several global campaigns and rulemaking processes like the Prague Conference, the U.S. Department of State's Clean Tech Program, look to exclude Chinese tech firms, apps, and cloud providers. These pressures, coupled with China's recent behavior in Asia, has compelled US allies and partners to bar Huawei and ZTE. Keeping recent Sino-India tensions aside, did these other developments compel India to rethink whether Huawei and ZTE should be allowed to operate for 5G in India. I mean, how compelling were these pressures independent of the economic logics around Huawei?
Look, I think they were compelling. And I think what the Indian government was trying to do was to try and find some sort of a middle ground between economic and security interests. The way I look at it, so let's look at this before May 2020, before the sort of tensions between India and China start to pick up. From an Indian government perspective, there were a few prisms through which you could look at this, right? You could look at it from the economic prism, which is that I have a cost-effective, high-quality vendor whom I can partner with. I could look at it from a security prism, wherein I have a cost-effective, high-quality partner, but there are security challenges, and given the use cases of 5G, those challenges are magnified to something that that would never have happened before. The kind of disruption that could be caused is very different from, say, 4G partners, 4G sort of investments. The third sort of prism is the strategic prism, which is that this geopolitics around 5G and potentially sort of global tech ecosystem splintering and the threat of India getting locked into one side simply because you chose economics over the rest of it. And now even if you want to make a strategic shift, the cost of making that shift is so much. And I think this is an argument that's played out in Europe, right? Where people have sort of argued that the cost of uprooting Huawei sort of equipment is going to be so significant that companies will need bailouts to be able to do that, or at least a long period of time to be able to sort of manage that. And I think you're seeing that in Europe even today, where Britain, with this shift in approach, has still taken a time frame by which companies need to switch away from Huawei. France is saying that you can still buy Chinese equipment till the end of this year, and then you have 7 years to phase it out. And from an Indian point of view, the argument is like, do you want to be in that position? Given that you're observing that this sort of, the world is being divided into these two sort of different camps. And still sort of last year, there was far greater uncertainty about whether you're seeing two camps emerging. Because, I mean, it might seem far more obvious to people that we are seeing a deep Sino-US split. But let's remember that in January 2020 is when they signed the phase one trade deal. So the options for so-called great powers, which are deeply coupled economically, to come to some sort of compromises always are there. Because at the end of the day, whatever the systematic competition between China and the US, neither side wants conflict. And each side sort of wants to limit that as much as they can. And therefore, for all the bickering that's happening, and I think some of that is election driven in the US also. So we need to wait and watch what happens after the election in the US. But the possibility of some sort of, detente between the two sides exists. And that complicates the situation for India. That do you then pick a side, knowing fully well that, China is your neighbor, and a neighbor with whom you have a history of hostility, a border tension, and more sort of tensions because of their investments in the region. So I think the argument, therefore, is that it's important for India to view it strategically. And I think in doing that, what government of India was doing was delaying as much as it could making that decision. I mean, the fact that the decision, that there was pressure, is evident when Trump visited India in February this year. He was praising, the chief of Reliance Jio, Chief of Reliance Jio, Mr. Ambani, was telling Mr. Trump that, ours is the only non-Chinese network. And he was happy with that. So it clearly tells you that those pressures existed. And I think the consideration existed. My sense is that if it were not for the events of the last 4 or 5 months between India and China, this wasn't an easy decision that India had to make. And it wasn't a decision that seemed like the government wanted to make. It wanted to get a sense of what was happening with the British model before the current switch of limiting Huawei's engagement in Huawei or Chinese Tech's engagement in the core of the 5G network, and see if those sort of things worked out. See if there could be software solutions where you can firewall your systems in some way or the other while still getting the benefit of, you know, cheap, high quality Chinese products. And I think that's where India was in some way heading. Again, none of these decisions were taken or announced, but that's where it seemed to be heading, given that in January, a state-run service provider had announced that it would be partnering with ZTE.
Right. You know, we still don't know what the government's decision is on this issue, despite all the various developments that are happening on a seemingly daily basis. You know, if what you're saying is true, and there's clearly a case to be made on a potential U.S.-China rapprochement that could come back and backfire should India take a decision in any way that doesn't suit its interests, right? But is the government's reticence on this issue here also tied to existing Chinese tech investments in India, particularly in Indian unicorns like, you know, Paytm, Ola, Oyo Rooms, and there's several other ones I'm missing, but there's a substantial amount of Chinese money that's invested in some of these Indian unicorns. Is that also a constraint on India now?
So today, I honestly think that to me, look, from a strategic point of view, to have your adversary invested in your economy is always good for you. I find it baffling when people make the argument, and lots of this argument has been made in India in the last 4 or 5 months, when people make the argument about Chinese investments in India being fundamentally problematic. Now, I can understand that there are certain sectors where you may have certain issues and security concerns, and that's valid. Or, for example, even like Paytm and FinTech and those sorts of areas, where you may have issues with regard to data. How that's processed, how that stores, who has access to it, and all of that. That makes sense to me. But fundamentally, this is capital looking for profit-making opportunities. To me, and it's also a strategic asset for you, particularly when there is competition or when there is conflict potentially. So I don't think that there's necessarily a case to be made that this investment is problematic from an Indian point of view. I think India should be looking for more of this or should have been looking for more of this. I think the challenge that we had, that the Indian government had, was our inability to direct Chinese investments in areas that we would have wanted them to reflect sort of far greater, particularly manufacturing, you know, sort of low-end manufacturing. I think for the longest time, India has wanted that. Yet that's not played out. And for whatever the reasons for why that's not played out, I think there are genuine economic reasons for why that's not happened, and there are political reasons for why that's not happened. But I think the effort from the government had been in that direction. And if you recall sort of last year when we had the second of the informal summits in October last year, one of the only tangible outcomes of that summit was the announcement of a working group of sorts between the Indian Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharaman and Chinese Vice Premier Hu Jintao to talk about the trade deficit and the manufacturing partnership and those sorts of things. Now, that group has never met because the announcement came in October, and then we had the pandemic in January, and then subsequently things have been downward spiral. But I think that tells you a little bit about what our priorities were with regard to Chinese capital. So I don't think that from an Indian government's point of view, the objective has always been to get China engaged more in our economy, but direct that investment in areas where we would want to see that to be directed. On 5G, the challenge would have again been this, right? If you choose one side over the other, do you let go of that investment? Or what is the signal that you're sending? And what could then be the political backlash? Which, for example, the Chinese had threatened everybody around the world who was making these choices. So I remember last year, it was the Indian ambassador to China was also in July last year, in June or July last year, there was a report about the Indian ambassador to China being sort of summoned and the Chinese side sort of warning India about making a decision sort of barring Chinese partnership and Chinese engagement in India's 5G sector, basically saying that this would be seen as discriminatory and it would have sort of consequences and so on and so forth. So I think the Chinese were making that argument. From an Indian point of view, our objective was to try and direct investments in areas that we wanted to do further, because we realized that there would be ripple effects of that decision.
You know, I have two more questions, Manoj. One on China and the last one on 5G. You know, 2 days ago, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi unveiled a new global data security initiative that seeks to erect alternate global rules around data as a rejoinder to growing US pressure. Now, this initiative, you know, appears important and to me somewhat a digital equivalent to China's policies on development assistance, where we see a clear different approach compared to what the Western world has been doing for decades, right? But the implications here are somewhat greater. I mean, this could finally lead to a separate internet where countries would operate. Do you think China can create an alternate technology order governed by distinct rules and standards on hardware, data, privacy, that affects technology development and as a result, the digital trade between countries?
Yeah, I mean, I think they have all the ingredients for it. And I think the challenge is this, right? A lot of the hardware for, sort of the ingredients for this exist within the sort of Digital Silk Road Initiative, right? And the expansion of that. But as we've seen, because the supply chains of technology products are so interlinked from design to actual creation, actual manufacturing, and then actual sort of then assembly and everything, the DSR also sort of links to American design, Taiwanese manufacturing, design in Europe. So it's really difficult if you can set standards but not have the capacity to then create the products. And in Huawei's case, we are seeing that with its current chips sort of running out. And that's a challenge. China imports $300 billion worth of semiconductors. So it's significantly dependent on the external world to do this. So if you see a decoupling of the manufacturing supply chain in one way or the other, which I'm sure no company, whether it's American, European, or Chinese, wants to see, because it will deeply impact the future of all of these companies. Yet, if you see that play out, then the challenge that exists for China is how do you sustain yourself? How do you sustain doing, creating these products and manufacturing them and sustain them over a period of time? I think there's an effort in trying to do that and trying to address that domestically also. And we're seeing that with regard to their sort of increased investments in semiconductors, increased investments in domestic manufacturing. Xi Jinping has been talking about self-reliance in core technologies for a while now. It's going to be some time before they achieve anywhere near what they want to in each of these areas. But that will be sort of critical to be sort of the standards I see are going hand in hand with that. That you have the capacity to do this, plus you have a set of rules which people, at least with markets that you are servicing and that you are dominating, have to agree to because you are servicing them. And where else are they going to go? So a lot of Africa, where the Digital Silk Road is significantly is critical to their sort of ICT networks in a lot of African countries, it's going to be extremely expensive for these African countries to suddenly uproot Chinese tech, develop the entire ICT system and say, we're going to shift. So you can see them accepting these standards and saying, okay, there will be bargaining, of course, but you can see them accepting these standards and saying, okay, this works for us. So there is clearly scope for China to do this. There is clearly potential for China to do this. And to my sense, that is where they want to go because they see this as a strategic threat. But because of the interlinked nature of global tech supply chains, there are these sort of foundational challenges that exist for them. And the better they can address those, the more they can do this.
You know, one thing that I've sort of observed is that the Chinese have a better understanding of how to integrate these different hardware and software elements into a cloud than most other countries. And I think that gives them an advantage, whichever way they go. And there's clearly scope there in other parts of the world, especially Africa, Southeast Asia, where there will be demand for greater Chinese involvement.
Indeed, yeah.
My last question, has to do with 5G in India. One thing that struck me in debates around 5G in India, and other technology issues is that even if there's a 5G network and landscape, which could lead to strides in artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, and other innovations, is the impact of these technological developments on larger political and development questions, including some that you raised earlier, like the digital divide, the lack of digital connectivity, unresolved questions around data, how it will be managed and used, the rural urban gap in terms of development, right? Are these discussions fundamentally delinked, or is technology increasingly seen just through an instrumental lens and not as a marker that could deepen existing social and political fissures?
I think there has been conversation. In fact, there's been far greater conversation as the sort of years have gone by. I mean, let's just first look at privacy as an issue. I mean, this is something that went up to the Supreme Court, with the Supreme Court talking about privacy being a fundamental right in India. If you look at what's happened over the last 3, 4, 5 months with regard to the pandemic, there's far greater conversation today in India about, while everybody's talking about being online and functioning online and adapting to the new ways of the world right now, there's greater, somewhat conversation about what are the opportunities that are lost for the people who are going back to their villages. I mean, a classic case is, I live in a city in India, fortunate enough to hire somebody to come and cook for me. The lady who comes and cooks for me has 2 children who study in a municipal school in this city. Once the pandemic hit and there was migration back home, she had to make a choice. Do I go back home? Do I stay in this city? Because I've lost income because I no longer have to work because people are no longer hiring cooks. Yet she's made a choice to stay in the city because she can access cheap smartphones and better internet connectivity so that as the municipal school went online, her children can study. So the challenge for her is whether she can go back home to her village or not do that because the connectivity there will be poor. Now, this is a conversation that's still not at the scale that it should be, but it's happening. And people are thinking about this. And I think governments increasingly, given the sort of new situation that we are in right now, the pandemic will sort of force greater focus on deepening internet penetration, bridging this digital divide. Because it's this last few 4 or 5 months that have made the costs of it far more apparent than they were if they were not in the past. And I think that's the kind of conversation that's beginning to happen in India today. The real world effects of that divide are sort of felt far more acutely today than they were maybe a year and a half ago or so. There was conversation a year and a half ago. Digital India was a important aspect of government plans. Significant amount of money got spent on that also. And to be honest, in the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've seen this concerted effort. So there has been greater penetration, obviously. But I think what the last few months have shown us is that there is still a serious issue. There is still a deep divide. And we need to spend more to do this. And to me, to be honest, this is a case of an opportunity in a crisis. Because one of the only ways that we can come out of this sort of economic stagnation that we find ourselves in right now after the pandemic is by massive government investment in infrastructure. That is one critical aspect of it. And I hope that we can spend on things like not just physical infrastructure like schools and hospitals and things like that, but also digital infrastructure, which is, again, something that I think we should take a leaf out of the Chinese playbook, because that's what they are doing right now. They're basically spending significantly on emerging technology and digital infrastructure. I have not seen this conversation so far in India, and I think that's because we are still dealing with the first sort of fallout of the pandemic, which is stabilizing the economy. But I'm hoping that down the road, this is where we will spend. And I'm hoping that this is a conversation that will pick up in India going forward. Because at least from a general, I wouldn't say the media so much, because the Indian media has been focused on all sorts of other things over the last few months. But I think in sort of general public conversation, there's a greater awareness about the need for digital connectivity even in far-flung parts of the country. And therefore, the demand for this is also going to be greater from the people who are the most affected today, because I think they realize also what they would have not 6, 8, 10 months a year ago about the loss of opportunity by not having this connectivity. So I'm hoping that this will sort of stir many more positive outcomes down the road.
Great. Manoj, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and speaking about India, 5G technology, China, and so much more. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.